That it? Oliver looked away, shuffled his feet a bit. They came by, yeah. Said you were dangerous. Escaped prison. Seemed angry I sold you a car. Well, how were you supposed to know? Oliver's gaze swung back to Mark's. That's what I told him. What else did they say? He shrugged. Just, you know, to let him know if I saw you again. And? You gonna do that? Oliver danced a bit, looked around the room, everywhere but Mark's face. I'll make this easy on you, Oliver, because you've been good to me. You sell me a car, and I'll be on my way. Give me a 10-minute lead. Then, if you see fit to call the cops... He gave a casual shrug as if it were no big deal. I'm good with that. You have to do what you have to do. Your civic duty. I get it. Fought in the war, you know. Killed some Germans. Now them Nazis, they was bad guys. You don't look so bad. Marx laughed. Things get blown out of proportion in the news. Half the stuff they say about you isn't true. The cops exaggerate, lie. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. Now, he held up a hand and dipped his chin. I'm no saint, I gotta tell you. But who is? Oliver nodded, his jaw working out the nerves. So, why don't you and me take a walk outside and I'll pick a car that works for me? Don't have no more that cheap. They're all more expensive. That's okay. I brought some more money with me tonight. He gestured with his left hand, waving Oliver to follow him to the door. The man complied, and they walked onto the fairly well-lit sales lot. Marks did not want to stand to the lights too long for fear a passerby would recognize him and call it in. Not to mention the circulating police cars, many of which he was sure were added to a round-the-clock patrol to search for him. He ducked his head down and tried to angle his face away from the avenue that fronted Oliver's used cars. He grabbed hold of Oliver to prevent him from slipping on the ice that coated the asphalt. Just trying to keep you from falling. You hit your head at your age. Could be fatal. Need to put salt down. Melt this stuff. You want? I'll throw some down after I pick out a car. Appreciate that. He lumbered along a few feet, then asked, How much you looking to spend? I need something newer. Leather interior, air conditioning, traction control, maybe a Mercedes or BMW. Oliver stopped shuffling and turned stiffly to face Marks. I'm kidding, Oliver. A guy can dream, right? He laughed and got a cigarette-stained smile from the proprietor. How about a sedan? Late 1990s or early 2000s? You still dreaming? Because you're talking a lot more money. Like 2 or 3,000. You got that much? I can spend about 3. Show me what you have. Oliver turned left down a row of cars, past a dark gray Chevrolet Impala and shuffled up to an adjacent Toyota. Now there's this one here, or down the next. This one's perfect, actually. The Chevy. It was better than Oliver could know, because it was parked in a darker area of the lot and farther from the avenue. More importantly, the vehicle had tinted windows, which would reduce the risk of being seen and identified. Oliver turned and glanced at the Impala. He knew the price without looking at the sign in the window, which read $3,800, a little more than his customer's budget. But this is an 05, and it's perfect for my needs. Oliver, either knowing the first rule of sales that you did not try to talk your customer out of a more expensive product, or realizing it would be better not to argue with Marks, nodded his head and upper body, which moved stiffly in unison. Okay. He reached to the bulging carabiner on his side and selected the correct key and unclipped the quick release. Tried it in the door and it worked. He left it hanging out of the lock and turned to Marks. I can give this to you for $3,500, cash price. That'll work. He moved behind Oliver as if he was examining the car, then put his forearm around the man's neck and pulled, held it firm. Oliver squirmed and grabbed at Mark's meaty limb, but a moment later, Oliver lost consciousness and stopped resisting. Marks supported him while he opened the Chevy's back door and pushed his limp body onto the seat. He walked around to the front, turned over the engine, and drove Oliver to the office. After making sure no one was watching, he shut off the dome light and offloaded the body. He carried him to the desk and set him in the chair, Oliver's head resting on the blotter. He found a length of rope and strung it around the man's neck, tied it tight. He grabbed Oliver's winter hat, black calfskin on the outside with the lamb's wool lining and large ear flaps, and pulled it over his own head. Warm, yes, but it also obscured more of his face than the ball cap, and given the temperature, no one would question it. Mark stopped and considered his course of action. If they found Oliver's body, they would know he had returned and taken another car, then killed him. Maybe Oliver kept an inventory of vehicles. Maybe he didn't. But Marks could not take the chance. The cops did, after all, track the Buick back here, so there were records of ownership somewhere. Of course there were. If Oliver had family and reported him missing, it might be a day or two or three, and the police might just think Oliver was scared about Marks coming back, so he disappeared for a while. That uncertainty was better than his body being found, which, if he left him in the office, would happen in the morning, as soon as the first customer came knocking and saw him through the window, unresponsive at his desk. Taking Oliver with him was definitely the better way of going about it. Marks looked around the office and found Oliver's old cell phone in the bottom of the cash drawer, which contained $900, and shoved both the money and the handset in his pocket. He found the charger dangling from the wall outlet and took that as well. Marks lifted Oliver off the seat and put him in the car. He would find some place to discard him later tonight, when potentially inquiring eyes were fast asleep. Problem solved. All in all, a productive evening. But, body disposal aside, he was not finished. Chapter 45. Jesus Christ! Robbie tossed the messenger bag off his shoulder and ran over to Vale, who was sitting on the couch, a gel pack by her side. What happened? I got slugged a few times by Roscoe Lee Marks. You caught him? Vale chuckled sardonically. More like he caught me. Robbie squinted confusion. He kidnapped you? She sucked her bottom lip and nodded. Yep. Where? Mason District Police Department parking lot. Robbie sat there a long moment staring at her, apparently realized she was serious and said, How the hell does that happen? He's a smart son of a bitch. Are you okay? Your face is swollen, but it looks redder than it really is because I've been icing it. Did you see a doctor? No fractures, mild concussion. Or maybe two. Headache? Oh, yeah. So you're off work for a few days? Vale harumphed and grabbed her temple. Ow! Don't make me laugh. But before you give me a speech on following doctor's orders, how'd you know that's what I was going to do? She looked at him. Did you really just ask me that? Fine. But you really should listen to the doctors. It looks worse than it is. Does my father know? Robbie asked, referring to Vale's boss, ASAC Thomas Gifford. Negatory, and neither does my unit chief. Vale placed a hand on Robbie's, and it's going to stay that way. I didn't go to one of the Bureau's medical facilities. I just went to a doc in the box, told them my fiancé punched me around a bit. A cop should be by in half an hour to talk to you. Robbie shook his head. This is not funny, Karen. You need to take care of yourself. I'm not having any problems thinking, concentrating, or remembering. But if you notice me getting angry or emotional, that could be a bad sign. I'm not sure I could tell the difference. Good one. Look, this could all be better by the morning, and I'm taking the rest of the evening off. It's 7:30, Karen. There's not much left of the evening. As long as Marks is still out there, none of us can let up, because he's not going to let up. He's going after Jasmine, I'm sure of it, and I haven't heard from her in almost 2 days. Robbie sighed. It's hard to argue with you when I'd do the same thing in your place. Come lie with me on the couch. He kicked his shoes off and unhooked his holster, then snuggled up to Vale. She had just gotten comfortable when her phone rang. Leave it, Robbie said. Vale groaned. I can't. She fished it out and sat up quickly, too quickly. Sorry I went off the grid. Jasmine? Vale glanced at the number. You using a different phone? I think I saw my father. He was a block away, but if it was him, that's too close for my taste. I freaked, hauled myself away, tossed my phone again. Sorry. I want to meet with you, tell you what's been going on, ask you some questions, and ask you one more time to accept police protection. How about now? Have you had dinner? Vale closed her eyes. Shit. Actually, I haven't. She glanced at Robbie, who was now sitting up as well, shaking his head no. If you don't mind me bringing my fiancé along, I'd love to have dinner. I don't know, Karen. I've got a concussion. I'm not supposed to drive, especially at night. What happened? Your father happened. A couple of right hooks. Or backhands. Who remembers? You serious? Robbie's a federal agent. You can trust him. Where should we meet you? There's an Indian restaurant on New Hampshire at M Street, Rasika. It's a wedge-shaped building, and the bar sits in the corner with walls that are all windows. I can keep an eye on both streets, make sure my father's not coming, and he's not likely to look for me in D.C. Does that mean she's been staying somewhere in D.C.? Or maybe she is now. On our way. Give me some time to get out there. Vale hung up and dialed her compatriot in her other life, FBI Supervisory Special Agent Aaron Uzi Uziel, head of the Washington Joint Terrorism Task Force and fellow Black Ops team member. How's my favorite redhead warrior princess? Uzi asked. At the moment, you don't want to know, but I need your help and I don't have a lot of time. You know, all you've got to do is ask. I need some kind of tracking device, Vale said. Something tiny that I can put on someone. Something they won't know is there. It has to give me the ability to find them if I need to, and without them knowing. I've got just the thing. You do? No. I just thought that's what you wanted to hear. Uzi, I'm not really in the mood. Yes, I have something you can use. You really doubted that I'd come to your rescue? I'm your knight in shining armor. Robbie sitting 2 feet away. Right. Tell him I said hi, and that I didn't really mean the knight thing. Just a figure of speech. I'm heading into the city to meet the target. Can you bring it to 23rd and M? I will cancel my dinner plans and meet you there. Oh, sorry. Just kidding. No plans. I'll be there in 20. That'd be great. I do miss working with you, Uzi. I know. Robbie drove and parked in front of a bus stop on the corner. Uzi pulled in behind them, and Vale and Robbie got out. It was a relatively dark street, with only a couple of street lamps on the entire block. Uzi kept his headlights on and, judging by his expression, immediately noticed the condition of Vale's face. What happened? Don't ask. Robbie said as he gave Uzi a shoulder hug. Seriously, you okay? Nothing a little time, Tylenol and ice won't cure. He gave her a long look, then reached into his leather overcoat and pulled out a small case and popped it open, revealing a tiny device. GPS tracker stores locations internally, but also transmits and triangulates a signal using local Wi-Fi networks. It's not 100% accurate, but it'll get you pretty close, assuming there are active Wi-Fi networks nearby. Vale took it from him. Does it need a power source? All electronic devices need a power source, but this is a low-power unit and it's fully charged, so it'll last about a month. Plenty of time. Better be. One last thing. Give me your phone. She handed over the Samsung, and he tapped a few times, then handed it back. Open that Find Me app I just installed. Vale did as instructed. Okay, now what? It has to initialize and communicate with the tracker. In a few seconds, you'll see a string of coordinates, GPS coordinates. If you ever want to see where that device is or where it's been for the past week or so, open the app and let it download the data from the server. If it takes a long time to connect, there's something interfering with the signal. Could be any number of things. You can try moving to a different location, but it may not be you. It could be where the tracker is. She saw the numbers populate and then tapped them and a map loaded, showing their current location. Perfect. Thanks, Uzi. This is a beta, but it's performed very well so far. Next version will have cell capability, so tower pinging can be used for positioning as well as burst updates to the server. We'll be able to tell if its signal is being interfered with and determine the interference type. She turned to Robbie. I love it when he talks techie. So sexy, don't you think? One last thing, Uzi said, ignoring her dig. It's technology. Vale tilted her head. Yeah? What does that mean? It means it gives you awesome capabilities, but it can also be the scourge of your life. Shit happens. It's not foolproof, and sometimes these things have glitches. Is that your way of apologizing before it goes haywire? Didn't say it would, but I know you. You'll want to put a fist through a wall when it doesn't work the way you want it to work, when you want it to work. I'm not like that. Uzi looked at her, his lips thinning, holding back a smile. Fine, but I have confidence in you. Your last gift paid dividends again. My last gift? The Tanto? He grinned fully. Sedek. It saved my life today. I mean that. Uzi's face went slack. His eyes again found the bruises on her face. I'm glad you're okay. That knife has some serious mojo forged into its steel. Thanks for sharing some of it with me. How are things with you? Robbie asked. Good? Yeah, Uzi pulled his eyes away from Vale. All things considered, the way things are headed, counterterrorism will keep me gainfully employed until I'm a frail old man. How's the drug business? Unfortunately, I can say the same thing. He gave Uzi another hug. Stay safe. You too, brother. Uzi looked at Vale. I'd tell you to stay safe too, but judging by the looks of you, I think that train's left the station. Chapter 46. Robbie turned on to New Hampshire and came to a stop in front of the restaurant to let Vale off. You sure you want to do this? Meet with Jasmine? The tracking device. That's a bit over the top, no? Absolutely not. Look what happened to me today. There's no way she would have gotten away from Mark's. I have no idea what he has planned for her, other than death. But I'm guessing he'd keep her around for a bit to prolong her suffering, give her what he perceives she gave him. With this thing, if she goes missing, I'll be able to find her, hopefully in time. Hey, this is your case. I'm just giving you some unsolicited feedback. I'm still going to try to convince her to let us put her in a safe house. I felt helpless these past 2 days. I feel responsible for her. That's ridiculous. It may be ridiculous, but it's how I feel. Okay. Vale gathered up her purse and wrapped her fingers around the door handle. You think I'm wrong? About putting a tracking device in someone's purse without her knowing? Vale frowned. About wanting to move her to a safe house? Robbie looked out at the street. I don't know, Karen. You don't know? On the one hand, I do think it'd be smart. As a law enforcement officer, yeah, that's what I'd say. But I also know what goes on behind the scenes. Sometimes cops don't do their jobs. Shit happens. And in the end, if you know what you're doing, it might be safer if you took care of yourself. But that's only if you understand the criminal mind and the principles of staying off the grid and keeping safe. Yeah, if it was you or me, maybe that'd make sense. Maybe. But in this case, from what you've told me, she's done okay caring for herself. She seems self-aware and security conscious. Vale scoffed. Robbie turned to face her. Look, you tell her what you feel is best for her. Like I said, it's your case.
Noted. Vale opened the door. Go park. I'll meet you inside.
She passed by an outdoor dining area, vacant because of the cold weather, and entered through the glass doors, stepping into a dimly lit contemporary restaurant abuzz with patron chatter. Vale checked in at the hostess station on the left. The woman grabbed a couple of menus and led her past a wall of stacked wine bottles that led to the main dining rooms and into the bar's lounge, which, as Jasmine described, was shaped like a wedge and bounded by tall windows. Jasmine was seated at the corner table with a view of both 23rd and M Streets. Vale pulled her chair away and gave Jasmine a hug, then took a seat. She studied her blonde wig and dark-rimmed glasses and cocked her head. Nice disguise, I think.
Hey, if it keeps him from recognizing me, it's worth it.
You really think that's enough to hide from your own father? She looked away.
Maybe he feels that bond. I just feel betrayed.
Oh, he feels betrayed, too. You look awful, she said, leaning forward and appearing to notice Vale for the first time. I don't feel so great either, Vale forced a smile. Robbie's parking. He'll be here in...
I think he just walked in.
She gestured over Vale's left shoulder. Ladies, Jasmine, good to meet you.
Same here.
Vale saw her eyes flicker wider for a moment.
Down, girl, he's mine.
Jasmine giggled.
Lucky woman.
Robbie sorted out the cramped space in front of him. Would you like something to drink?
I would, Jasmine said, but I can't. I need all my faculties.
Vale waved her off. You're here with us. You can relax for an hour. We've got your back. She sighed.
Karen, that's the point, isn't it? I don't want anyone having my back. I can't do it that way. I tried that once and...
The waiter interrupted with a welcome and proceeded to talk to them about the menu and specials, and then asked if they needed more time. We just got here, Robbie said, so...
You asked me to trust you, Jasmine said. Will you trust me to pick out the dishes?
Vale and Robbie shared a look.
Okay.
After asking about dietary limitations and dislikes, Jasmine ordered calamari bao chao, prepared with Kashmiri chilies, tawa bangen, eggplant with spiced potato and peanut sauce, lamb Kashmiri, set with caramelized onions, ginger, and fennel powder, and a couple sides of chili olive naan.
You just made me very hungry, Robbie said, and thirsty. I'll have a Bengali tiger IPA.
So how have you been holding up? Vale asked, as she handed her menu to the waiter. Jasmine lifted her water glass.
Let me answer that with another question. How close are you to catching him?
Vale palpated her swollen jaw. Not close enough.
What happened? You said he hit you? If he hit you, you were with him?
Vale recounted the events of the day. Jasmine shook her head. I'm sorry you got hurt. At least you fared better than his other victims.
The waiter brought Robbie's beer and told them the appetizers were en route.
My ordeal aside, Vale said, I wanted to ask you about Booker Gaines, your dad's childhood friend. Know much about him?
He's a bad guy. Lots of run-ins with the law. I didn't like it when my dad hung out with him.
Anything else?
They were really good friends, spent a lot of time together.
What did they do when they hung out?
What did my father do most of the time when he wasn't killing people or working? Bars. He spent a lot of time at bars.
What kind?
Jasmine drew her chin back.
What kind of bars? What do you mean?
Where they serve alcohol and...
Were they gay bars? Jasmine's face stiffened. Robbie glanced at Vale, lifted the beer to his lips, and refrained from interrupting.
You okay?
Yeah, Jasmine said with a laugh. I just wasn't expecting that. So you think my father is gay?
I know about the incident with Vincent Stuckey when you came home unexpectedly from your soccer tournament.
The waiter brought the calamari and eggplant with spiced potato and set them in the center of the table. Jasmine reached for the calamari and put some on her plate.
Do you remember that? When you came home with...
Yes.
She stuck a piece of food into her mouth, as if that would relieve her of the obligation to say anything further. Vale scooped some eggplant onto her plate to give Jasmine a minute to answer.
He was gay or bi, she finally said. He was married, remember?
Yeah, although there are gay men who marry because they don't want to come out and it gives them cover.
I know, she said, conceding Vale's point. We never talked about that night, about what I saw.
Is Booker Gaines also gay?
No idea.
Vale nodded slowly and accepted her answer, moved on.
Is that a sensitive subject for you?
My father is a sensitive subject. My childhood is a sensitive subject. I'm sorry I wasn't completely forthcoming with you earlier. I thought I had a normal father who loved me. No, check that. I thought I had a normal father, period.
Jasmine took a long drink of water, as if composing her thoughts or herself.
I could write a book about it, she said with a derisive chuckle.
Oh, wait, I did.
Vale decided to drop that line of questioning as well. She observed the tension in Jasmine's face as she brought the glass again to her lips. The waiter set the remaining plates on the table.
I think you should consider letting us protect you.
Jasmine stopped drinking suddenly and set the water down.
He sent me an email, you know.
Vale threw a glance at Robbie.
When? What did he say?
Jasmine kept her gaze on the food.
That he was going to make me pay.
For turning him in?
She shrugged.
And for what I wrote in the book, probably. I don't know. It was just that one sentence. He didn't sign it, but I knew it was him.
Vale set her fork down.
This is why we need to protect you. No. We'd move you to a safe house, guarded by the Marshals Service. They do this every day, Jazz. Your case doesn't present anything new or different for them. Do they protect witnesses from serial killers?
Vale sat back.
No. Have they ever protected a victim from a serial killer? Their specialty is witness protection. That doesn't answer my question.
Well, Vale said, not to my knowledge.
But I'm not a witness who's waiting to testify. My father isn't your ordinary criminal. Some mafia thug who pulls out a submachine gun or sets off a bomb. So this is different on just about every level.
She turned to Robbie.
You're a federal agent. Tell me what you think I should do.
Robbie glanced at Vale in mid-chew, a flick of the eyes to tell her she had better bail him out.
I don't think we should put Robbie in the middle of this.
What exactly does that mean?
Jasmine asked as the waiter brought the lamb and naan and set them by the edge of the small table. Robbie swallowed.
It means that I think you should listen to Karen. No one understands the criminal mind better than she does. No one understands a serial killer's mind better than she does. So if she tells you that staying in a safe house guarded by U.S. Marshals is the way to go, that's what you should do.
Jasmine looked at him a long moment. Robbie broke her gaze and started dishing out the lamb.
This smells great.
You're just saying that, Jasmine said, because you have to. I can tell.
If I had a witness like you, and it was my case, Robbie said, that's the advice I'd give her.
And if it were you? Or Karen?
Different and irrelevant. We're trained law enforcement officers.
Jasmine did not say anything further about it, nor did Vale.
And if she was not going to accept protection, that meant Vale needed to put the tracker in Jasmine's purse at some point fairly soon, without her noticing.
I should have given it to Robbie, then asked her to go to the bathroom with me.
Vale thought of slipping it to him under the table, but if Jasmine, whose powers of observation were sharp in her heightened state, happened to notice her secretly passing something to him, she would become suspicious. And if she discovered it was a device meant to report on her location, she might never talk to Vale again, even if the tracker was meant for her benefit. Vale thought about lovingly taking Robbie's hand and placing the microchip in his palm, but it was small, and if he was not expecting it and dropped it, shit.
Robbie checked his watch. Almost lost track of time.
Yeah, Vale said. I know. The night's flying by, but that was yummy. Great picks, Jazz.
She folded her napkin and set it on the table.
I've got to use the little girl's room.
Maybe if she sees me go, she'll think of following. If I can get back to the table before she does.
But Jasmine did not bite. She stayed at the table, chatting away with Robbie.
When Vale returned, Robbie had already signed the credit card bill.
Jesus, that was fast.
Panic creeped into her chest. Her heart rate increased, and she cursed herself for not thinking it through better. Then again, she had a concussion. She had to cut herself some slack.
Since when?
Thanks for dinner, Jasmine said, and thanks for your help, Karen, and for caring. I know you mean well. I just think I'm better equipped to handle this than you give me credit for.
I get it. I'll back off. I've said what needed to be said. I came face to face with your father today, and honestly, if it was you instead of me, you wouldn't be here to talk about it.
She looked deep into Jasmine's eyes and let the comment penetrate. Jasmine twisted her lips and gathered up her jacket and purse.
Obviously, I hope you're wrong about that.
Here, Robbie said, let me help you on with your jacket.
Vale reached out and Jasmine instinctively handed her the purse as Robbie held out the coat, and Jasmine slipped her right arm into the sleeve. But Robbie had squeezed the material in his fist and her hand got stuck.
Oh, hang on. Sorry, He shook the material and then guided her fingers into the opening. There you go.
She shrugged it into position and buttoned it as they walked to the exit. They hugged, and Jasmine promised to reply when Vale texted or called her. As she got into the cab, Robbie turned to Vale.
Did you do it?
I did. Thank you. That was quick thinking. I didn't plan it out very well.
It's okay. I saved the day.
Vale stood on her tiptoes and gave him a kiss.
Yes, you did.
Chapter 47. Marks sat in the dark sedan, wanting to turn on the radio, but preferring not to risk running the battery down on a frigid evening. He did not know how much life it had left, and the fewer people he had contact with, the better. Even a tow truck driver responding to a jumpstart call could identify him. So he chose quiet solitude, moving his feet and pumping his calves to keep the blood flowing. While he was tired and cold and hungry, he tried to keep it in perspective. He was free, calling his own shots and directing his own destiny, and that was worth cherishing.
Earlier in the evening, while parked down the block from Vale's house, Marks had seen her husband pull into the driveway, and 10 minutes later they were back in his vehicle headed into D.C. That he and Vale were meeting Jasmine was an unexpected bonus. It was what he had been hoping and planning for, because he had no other way of finding her. What's more, the timing could not have been better. The darkness would serve as an accomplice to what he intended to do. Now, as his buttocks began to go numb, Jasmine exited the restaurant, followed by Vale and her husband. When Jasmine climbed into the back of the taxi, Mark started the Impala's engine and pulled the gear shift into drive as the cab pulled out onto M Street. The sedan continued on to an area in the outskirts of the city, passing alongside the Potomac on the George Washington Memorial Parkway and into Alexandria. Snow started falling again, and he switched on his wipers. Marks grew increasingly cautious, as the longer he spent on the road following the taxi, the greater the likelihood that the driver would notice and mention it to his passenger. Or he would keep looking in the rearview mirror, which his daughter would inevitably note. She was sharp, like her mother. Too sharp for her own good. As the area turned residential, Marks began to wonder if he should break off pursuit and think of some other way of finding out where she was staying. But how would he go about locating her when he could not risk contact with anyone? Just as he pulled the Chevy against the curb, the taxi stopped and let Jasmine off. She glanced around and then continued on foot, plodding through the snow. After watching Jasmine trudge along for another block, Marks wondered aloud what the hell she was doing. Why did she get out of the car? Was she short on money and had to walk the rest of the distance? In this biting cold? In the snow? On the ice? No decent cabbie would let a woman off at night in this weather just to save a few bucks. Maybe she got out so no one would know where she lived, not even the taxi driver. A bit extreme, but then again, she had to know he would keep coming after her until he found her and killed her. Viewed that way, it made perfect sense. He pulled back into the street and drove slowly after her. But how long could he follow her at a low speed before she caught on? Jasmine would notice such a thing. Just as he was mulling that question, Jasmine stopped. She turned and faced him, and she knew. She took off running, slipping and trying to stay on her feet, then turned right down a side street. Marks accelerated, then swerved around the corner and slammed his wheels against the curb. He cut the lights and engine and got out, running after her, falling twice but getting to his feet and keeping a bead on her. In fact, he was gaining. He was taller than she was, so his strides covered more ground than hers. The residential area was relatively dark, and because of the snow and cold, no one was out. At nearly 10 p.m., many were no doubt already asleep. He pushed the last 15 yards and tackled her, brought her down hard. She tried to scream, but he got his large hand around her mouth. She kicked and squirmed, the slippery snow making it harder on both of them. Neither could get enough purchase to gain significant leverage. But his right knee suddenly slid out from under him, and Jasmine landed a direct blow to his groin. It took his breath away, and he sprawled face down, snow infiltrating his mouth and nostrils. Marks groaned and struggled to his feet, but Jasmine was already running away, awkwardly slipping and sliding, going fast enough that he knew she was going to get away before he would be able to give pursuit. He dropped to his knees and waited for the pain to subside, then hobbled back to his car and drove away. Chapter 48. The next morning, with snow flurries continuing to fall, Vale awoke to an improving but persistent headache. She called Richard Prati and asked if he had time to answer a few questions about the arsons they had previously discussed. He agreed to meet her near the National Counterterrorism Center in McLean, Virginia, in half an hour, which was perfect because Vale was only 10 miles away. While en route, a thought occurred to her. She called Robbie, and he answered immediately. Everything okay? The car. I may have seen it parked out front.
What car? What are you talking about?
The raccoon. We looked out the window. I saw an old car, but it was down the street behind a truck. It may have been the one Marks was driving when he grabbed me.
What if it was him? He'd know where we live. How would he figure that out? I mean, that information isn't secret, but if you know what you're doing online, $25 can get you access to county records. Yeah, but he was imprisoned, what, 7 years ago? He probably doesn't know you can do that. Wait, there's an even easier way. He knows I work at the BAU. Assuming he can find a listing for it, it's probably out there somewhere. He goes there and waits for me. We've always wondered if something like that could happen. Now we know. She slapped the steering wheel. I saw that Buick in the unit's parking lot right before he kidnapped me.
You sure?
I'm sure I saw it in the parking lot. Not so sure it was the same one outside our house, but it would make sense. We need to stay somewhere. Move my aunt. Unless we stay, lure him there.
Use you as bait?
We could install surveillance cameras outside the house. Small ones that can't be seen. Park a Marshal Service undercover van a few blocks away, monitoring the feed.
No.
It might work. And we'd get to test your theory.
My theory? Robbie asked.
Forgo a safe house, look after ourselves. It's not the same and you know it.
Yeah, I know it.
But I've got to give you shit anyway.
I see you're feeling better.
She called Hurdle and asked him to get it set up, quietly, in case Marks was in the area. Whether or not they actually slept at the house was unimportant. She would figure that out later. But if Marks showed up, they would capture him on camera, and maybe capture him in the flesh. She walked into Greenberry's Coffee at 9:45 a.m., a few minutes before Prati, taking the time to peruse the two shelves of pastries. The large black-and-white cookie tempted her, and settled on a carrot muffin and two cups of the decaf Guatemalan coffee of the day. Prati entered in a dark suit and stamped the snow from his dress shoes.
I got you a decaf.
That works. Thanks.
He sat down at the square wooden table and dumped some sugar in the cup.
What happened to your face? Vale snorted.
You don't want to know. Trust me.
Nothing I need to talk to Robbie about? She laughed.
No. If he raised a hand to me... She decided to skip the joke because, given her history with her ex-husband, it really was not funny.
So, you've got some questions about one of your cases?
Not one of my cases, exactly. About those fires.
You're not commandeering that arson case, are you?
Vale laughed nervously. The Bureau had been accused of such tactics, but that was a long time ago.
Nope, I'm looking at it because it's got some common elements to my fugitive serial offender case.
I'm listening. The offender uses ether as the accelerant.
Ether?
Prati bent his head to the left.
Seriously? I don't know if I've ever heard of a case like that. I mean, there are so many efficient, low-cost accelerants. Why use that one?
Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, ethers are well-known chemicals, been around forever. In various forms, they've been used as a refrigerant, anesthetic, anti-knock gasoline additive, solvent. I think it's even used in paints.
In 5 to 10% concentration, it causes shallow breathing and loss of consciousness, but it's not used as an anesthetic anymore.
Why not?
It was discovered about 100 years ago. We've got more efficacious modern chemical compounds now with better patient risk profiles, and most importantly, they aren't flammable, he laughed. If the anesthetist weren't careful, he'd either cause a blue flame that'd singe wool and hair or actually blow up, exploding the patient's lungs, killing both him and the patient. Art Rooney, the profiler who's working the arson case, said there are also better, more efficient, more common accelerants. Why use this one, which might draw more attention? And why use one that can connect the serial murders to the arsons?
You're assuming someone would make that connection. Sounds like, until now, no one has.
How easy is it to get hold of?
Not hard at all, for non-medical uses. You can even buy it on eBay. It's also fairly easy to synthesize.
So much for that.
Why?
As with anything criminals use, if access is broad and not too restrictive, it's harder for us to track down the source or supplier.
Right. Prati pulled the lid off his coffee and added another packet of sugar. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to help you much here.
Anything else I should know about it?
Prati swirled his drink with the wooden stick. Steam spiraled up from the hot liquid.
Years before ether was put into service as an anesthetic, it was used as a recreational drug, sniffed from towels or handkerchiefs. I think it was called ether frolics. Nowadays, it still has a secondary market as a recreational inhalant drug, kind of like amyl nitrate or poppers. It's popular during sex, especially for homosexuals, because it facilitates anal intercourse. It relaxes smooth muscle, including the ones in the anal sphincter. Vale was staring at him, her mind suddenly racing.
Did I say something wrong? You're spacing out on me.
No. That might be incredibly helpful. My case, the offender's gay. So that would make sense as to why he'd use it. If he had it around for sex, why not use it for an anesthetic to subdue his victims? She nodded.
That answers the question Art had.
Did the killer deploy the anesthetic on a soaked rag?
How'd you know?
Prati took a drink of his coffee.
The inhaled concentration would be very high, so a couple of breaths would stun the victim for several minutes. Very effective.
We found a soaked rag at one of the crime scenes.
Did you also find a glass container?
Not that I remember. Why?
Part of what made ether so effective, aside from it being fat soluble, is that it's a solvent. It'd dissolve most plastic containers or anything else that's not inert. So he'd have to keep it in amber-colored glass. Most likely scenario is he soaked the rag somewhere else ahead of time, because ether has a distinct chemical smell, then put it in the vial, which had a silicone seal. He'd then bring it with him to the crime scene and remove the rag at the last minute and hold it over the victim's nose and mouth.
So the question is, how does that connect to the arsons?
Ah, well, Prati said with a grin, that's for you guys to figure out.
No kidding. Vale blew on her coffee, which was still throwing off steam. The earlier fires were set while Marks, my offender in the serial murders, was doing time in North Carolina and West Virginia.
Any chance he had a partner in crime?
Yeah, there's a chance. Thomas Underwood, the profiler who worked up the original assessment years ago before he retired, he thought there could have been an accomplice.
And I think I may know who to look at first.
I've got some homework to do. She took a long drink, but did not even taste the coffee.
Still, why take the risk? Prati lifted the cup to his lips.
How do you mean?
Well, let's say he did have a partner. Marks gets caught. He goes away. If his partner keeps killing with the same M.O., we'd know there's a problem. We'd know that we got the wrong guy or he had an accomplice. So the partner keeps killing and he modifies his M.O. so we don't connect the dots
or he sets crime concealment fires so you can't see what he's done to the body, which is his calling card.
Right.
Because what he does to the body is much more difficult for him to modify. It's a big reason why he's doing it.
But why take the risk of using the same chemical to set the fires that he uses to anesthetize his victims?
Prati set his cup down and removed the lid.
Because, as I said back at your house, killers don't know we can put these things together.
I get that, for sure. But Marks is a smart guy, smarter than most offenders we've encountered. From what I can tell, he's law enforcement-wise.
Prati again stirred his coffee. But you're not talking about Marks. You're talking about his accomplice.
Right. Vale rose from her chair. I've got to go. I need to look into this other guy, the potential partner.
Prati stood up.
So, I was helpful?
Richard, if this theory proves out, you may have just saved our asses. Chapter 49. Vale texted Art Rooney that she had some pertinent information on his case, then stowed her phone and popped open her car door. She looked around the Mason District parking lot and flashed on her run-in with Marks. Not a run-in, an ambush. She surveyed the area as she headed to the Marshal's RV, determined not to be caught unaware again. Vale walked into the command post to a crowded room which was not saying much considering its compact size. Everyone was present. "I've got some stuff to discuss," Vale said as she maneuvered her way to a seat.
"We've all got a number of things to address," Hurdle set his coffee mug down and rested his foot on a nearby ledge. "As I was saying, we've now got a second jerk-off in the wind, and since we were having so much success with the first one, I'm pleased as punch to have to add another to our plate." He nodded at Morrison. "Jim, you've got something on the Buick?"
"We found it in a ditch by the side of the road, not far from Great Falls Park. Covered by brush, well camouflaged."
"So he's probably got new wheels," Walter said. "Let's make sure local agencies notify us of all stolen vehicles."
"Already been done," Hurdle said, "but I'll make sure they're on top of it."
"You don't think he'd go back to that same used car lot?" Vale said.
"He'd be an idiot to do that," Ramos said, "and we know he's a smart son of a bitch."
"Unless he figures we think he's crazy to go back there.
We should put an undercover there."
"I think it's a waste of time, but easy enough to do," Hurdle said. "Rambo, set it up. Ben, what'd you dig up on Scott McFarlane?"
"Long sheet, but nothing that landed him in prison for more than 2 or 3 years at a time. A couple drug felonies for possession and an ADW that was pled down," he said, using law enforcement parlance for assault with a deadly weapon. "Did 10 months at county. Oh, and an attempted rape that was thrown out."
"He's obviously got a good defense attorney," Vale said.
"He was living in Richmond, moved to Roanoke, then supposedly lived out of a trailer on some property he inherited from his uncle."
"He still have that land?" Ramos asked.
"Nope," Tarkov flipped a couple of pages in his notebook. "There was some weird thing with the title and he lost it. I didn't have time to look into the problem, but bottom line is, he doesn't have that property or the trailer that was on it. But when they took the deed over, they found evidence of firearm storage and what appeared to be an underground bunker."
"Bunker?" Walters said. "What kind?"
Tarkov pulled up some photos on the PC at his station, angled the screen toward the group, and then clicked through the pictures.
"Freeze-dried food, 6 dozen-liter water bottles, LED tactical lights, shortwave radio, that kind of stuff."
"Looks like McFarlane is a survivalist," Curtis said.
"At best," Ramos leaned in for a closer look. "A militia member at worst. Preparing for the government apocalypse where the black helicopters descend and declare martial law. Could be why he was prepared with a submachine gun, in case we came knocking."
"We did," Vale said. "And he came up shooting."
"That goes along with stuff we found in the Gaines residence," Curtis said. "Guess I should refer to it as the house he commandeered."
He reached over and pulled out packets of stapled sheaves of papers.
"Good lead into what I wanted to discuss. Got a printout of preliminary forensic findings, including an inventory of items found throughout the Gaines house." He handed copies to Vale, who took one and passed the rest to Morrison, seated behind her. She began looking over the report, stopping at the list of DVDs.
"So it wasn't Gaines' face in the video we watched?"
"No," Curtis said. "Either way, that's got no impact on our ability to catch Marks or Gaines. Cyber team's evaluating the metadata on the discs to track their source."
Walters folded back a page. "Might help us catch the scumbags who create and distribute this trash, and maybe the ones who commit crimes against children, but it's not going to help net us our guys, directly at least, unless there's a local connection."
"I agree," Hurdle said. "We've got child pornography charges on him, but that's an administrative matter, way I see it. First, we got to find these knuckleheads. We'll worry about prosecuting them after the fact."
He paused, No doubt realizing that both were concerns.
"Whatever,"
You understand what I'm saying. We don't have any confirmation yet on McFarlane? Fail asked as she glanced over the itemized inventory. I was told DNA's being run. Problem is, we don't have any exemplars on file. I asked the lab to reach out to McFarlane's sister who lives in New Jersey. Not perfect, but it'll give us a real good idea if he was staying in that house with Gaines. And before you ask, yeah, we've got her under surveillance. Phone calls, email, text, all being monitored in case he contacts her. As Vale's eyes moved down the page, she got stuck on two words. Diethyl ether. That's a chemical, and it's got ether in the name. She pulled out her phone and tapped out a quick text to Prati. Karen? Yo, Vale. She hit send and looked up. All eyes were on her. Hurdle lifted his brow. You said you had some things to discuss? Yeah, I do. And depending on what Prati says, I may have more. Yesterday, before Marks got the drop on me, I mentioned an arson case the BAU's handling. I wasn't sure if it had anything to do with Marks, but I found out some stuff that leads me to think there's a connection. What? Who? I'm not sure yet.
Don't keep it to yourself, Morrison said.
I think I was telling you about the chemical. Her phone vibrated. She glanced at the display. Prati responded to her text. Hang on a sec. Diethyl ether is the chemical name. Ether is the common name for the chemical, like water is the common name for H2O. So, same thing. Vale looked up from her cell. And it just got a little more interesting. So the anesthetic that Marks used to temporarily subdue his victims was also used as an accelerant at the arson scenes for the crime concealment fires. She explained why such an approach was unusual. But we know that Marks is gay, and ether is sometimes used by homosexuals during sex. So that explains why he'd have it, why he'd be familiar with it, and its effects. And I'm willing to bet that the label has a warning on it about its flammability.
Does look increasingly likely there's a connection, Hurdle said.
And, Vale said, holding up the forensics inventory from Gaines' house, there's a six-pack of Sterno cans listed here. The arsonist used Sterno as well. Thomas Underwood, one of the founding profilers back in the late 70s who drew up the original assessment on Marks, initially thought there might be another unsub, an associate, but he abandoned that theory. Now it looks like he might have been right.
Gaines? Curtis asked. Or McFarlane?
Don't know. I would have said Gaines, but given what we're hearing about McFarlane, we don't know enough to say yet. That said, on this inventory of items taken from the Gaines house, there was a small bottle of diethyl ether, which my expert tells me is the chemical name for ether. They chewed on that a minute.
So what does this mean? Ramos asked. That the guy who was Mark's accomplice on the serial killings is also setting these fires? He's an arsonist?
Looks that way.
How does this help us?
It gives us another avenue of investigation, Hurdle said. Let's get up to speed with the investigating agency on these fires. See if there are any forensics we can track that'll give us a lead on where to look for these guys. If this accomplice is getting his chemicals locally, maybe it dovetails with something we've got on Marks.
That'd be helpful if we actually had something on Marks.